patient sepsis mortality. I would say those of you who came are getting a good shot.
You're welcome to use that.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank everyone for staying this long. The topic is hospital finances and inpatient sepsis mortality. The quote here, no margin, no omission. That's a quote developed by Sister Irene, basically saying you have to have money to do something. So starting from that idea, money has some value. My background is health service research. I work with a finance person in my department and also work with a clinician in our emergency room. So Dr. Nguyen is actually quite active in research and treatment of sepsis in ER and ICU. So trying to combine data, money, and clinical work. No relation to disclose, but if someone has money, I would consider taking it to do more research like this. Again, the first question is money. Is money important? Does money have any influence at all on quality of care? A sub-question was, does it matter if you're a profit or for-profit hospital? It seemed like a pretty easy question to me when I worked on the abstract. But as I got into it, I realized money is pretty easy. Of course, we can see a dollar. We know what a dollar is. How do you measure money for a hospital? There's something called cost, but there's different types of cost. You can look at funding stream. How many people come from Medicare? How much from Medicaid? So you get numbers. You can have ratios, which is not a raw number, but one number divided by another number. You can do all types of regression. Some I understand, some I don't understand. Lots of analysis. So how do you study money and quality? I'll talk about money first. We hear a lot about revenue. Is Medicare going to pay enough to hospitals for them to survive? Are HMOs going to pay enough to hospitals to survive? And all these people coming in with no insurance, how much can they pay the hospital? We hear a lot about revenue, but what about debt? Hospitals have a lot of debt. In California alone, there's over $30 billion worth of debt by hospitals. Californians have to retrofit to be strong enough to stand an earthquake. Hospitals issue bonds to buy MRIs, to buy CAT scan machines. There's a lot of debt. There's some theory saying if a hospital has debt, that's going to make them be more efficient, more capital efficient. They've got to pay off their debts. They're not going to be just doing all kinds of stuff. They're going to be focused on paying off their debt. That's a theory. Many studies have not found that. They have not found that debt is a good thing for a hospital. In fact, they found that debt may not make a hospital more capital efficient. It may not be a good thing. This last paper by Burnett, I won't even pretend to understand the methodology on that. They found that in the long run, debt is not good. It makes a hospital less efficient. But in the short run, you have to be good enough to get a loan these days. So you have to have strong enough finances to get a bond with decent interest rate. But you can actually get into what's called a debt-death spiral. You know, if you get too much debt, too high an interest rate, you just can't pay it off, and you go down and you end up in bankruptcy. So that's debt, which I think is, in the economics literature, they look a lot more at debt and capital efficiency rather than the revenue side, which I had always thought of as more important. How do you measure a hospital? There are some clinical factors. One study by Love et al., they came up with 62 financial measures and about 60, 70 clinical measures and did surveys of hospital executives and found that there were a few financial measures that executives thought, this is important. I should know how many days cash on hand do I have? That's an important thing to know. Profitability. These are things that could be useful to executives. The last quote I just put there, showing that there's not, a lot of studies don't really find a difference between profits and nonprofits when it comes to money, market share, how things are done. A number of studies have found that it doesn't really make a difference who owns you. You respond to money about the same way. Okay, so let's talk about money. How do you measure money? Quality of care, There's lots of ways to measure quality of care. I picked an easy one, death. If you're dead, bad quality of care. Live, better quality of care. Now, it's very crude. The advantage is it's very easy to measure. The nice thing about sepsis is they die a lot. You're looking at 20, 30, 40% mortality rate. So in terms of sample size measurement, it's easy mechanically. It does cost a lot of money. They estimate the severe sepsis about $17 million a year, or $17 billion, sorry. And lots of people die from it. The last bullet point, Dr. Nguyen actually does a lot of work on that. The best thing to do is someone comes in with sepsis, you know, their body's not working right, you stick a central line up their chest, you start measuring their blood flow, their oxygen, you start pumping stuff through them, antibiotics, different stuff. Pump them through that. If you do that, you can lower the rate of mortality. But you have to have a staff in place that knows how to put the central line in that does this, what's called EGDT, or they have bundles. So if you're doing these 6 or 12-hour bundles, you really can have lower mortality rates. Most hospitals are not implementing these bundles. So there is a quality of care measure linked to mortality of sepsis. It's not just a random event. Now, OSHPD is good. I don't need to talk too much about OSHPD now. The previous speaker is, because it's kind of bad. She knows about OSHPD's data. The OSHPD, all hospitals have to turn data into the state. You can go on the internet. These numbers, well, let me see laser because I point. These numbers are on the website. You can log on for free. Just go to this website. You can pull up a spreadsheet that shows all these financial ratio data, plus lots of other stuff. There's about 200 variables. For every single hospital in the state, about 367 hospitals for this year, 2007, the data goes back to 1995. So there's 13 years of data, public use, on the internet. So there's data. So I picked the financial ratio data because it's there. Pretty stable, measures lots of things. What do all these numbers mean? Here's a definition of a few of them. So you're comparing how much does a hospital have, equity, assets, debt, income. So these different ratios are comparing different things, obviously. The bottom, the PPE. So how much does their plan, the hospital, this stuff, how much does a hospital cost compared to how many beds do they have, how much debt do they have? So a lot of interesting ratios that make sense just on their face. Okay, now through the data. From the spreadsheets on the state, you can get all kinds of financial stuff. You get academic affiliation, bed size, ownership type, other variables too, but this is what we felt was most relevant for the study. Demographics, I use a public version of the data, so we actually have unknown age, gender, and race, but I just put a dummy variable in for the unknown values. OSHPD data has a primary diagnosis and 24 secondary diagnoses. You can go crazy working with diagnoses. So I pulled out from a couple different papers that looked at sepsis mortality, identified what type of organ failure. And sepsis is organ failure. So what organ is failing, or which ones are failing. So identified that, then also identified comorbidities that have been associated with sepsis mortality. Okay, so that's the data. So I went through, I used SAS, using SAS 9.1. So set the loops, just go through. Does the record have one of these diagnoses of sepsis? So used a handful of definitions, sepsis, severe sepsis, or septic shock. And just to note that these severe sepsis and septic shock diagnoses are relatively new. So there is some challenge in identifying sepsis cases. So the data had 3 data sets. The nice thing is you get a CD-ROM from the state, 1 year of discharges. There's about 4 million records per CD. So I went through, first of all, not every hospital turns in financial data. Kaiser, Shriners, there's hospitals that don't turn in financial data. So I threw them out. So going through the SAS, just let the computer run, pick out all the cases with financial data and just add them up. So about 9.5 million records. You can see 65% are nonprofits. About 3% had sepsis, about 3%. And 20 to 25% of the patients died in general during the hospitalization. These are the ratios. In general, there was, you can see the stars on the side, looking at just the means, there is a significant association. There's also correlation. Several are highly correlated. I just picked the ones that, the strongest ones. So operating margin and patient revenue margin are highly correlated, 0.9 or above. I just picked the one that was bivariate most associated with mortality. That was the approach I took. Skewed, the data is skewed. You have outliers. You have some things are truncated at 0 or 100%. I said, I'm just going to do median. Bottom, you know, just quartiles, lowest, highest quartiles. I'll put that in the regression. Just brief demographics. I used again, a couple different methods for risk adjustment and just added them up. How many organ failures? 0, 1, 2, or more. And it worked out pretty good. For one organ failure, I was looking about odds ratio of 3 to 4. And if they had two or more organ failures, looking at odds ratios of 7 to 9. So I feel like I did a decent job of adjusting for risk adjustment, for clinical severity. So I ran the model with age, gender, all the demographics that were shown earlier, all the hospital characteristics, all 8 financial ratios, and also putting in a fixed effect for the hospitals. There are about 250 some hospitals, so a fixed effect. Ran it for sepsis, all sepsis, and then focusing on just severe sepsis. Part of it makes sense. This is, you'd expect, okay, hospitals that had more money had lower death rates. Okay, good. You expect that. And also here, operating margin. Higher operating margin hospitals had less mortality than the hospitals in the bottom quartile. That makes sense. But two of them are the other way. You see here that more stuff, you have more expensive beds or more expensive buildings, not always going to lead to lower mortality. That's plant, property, equipment, and construction in progress. So all the other stuff. This one, we're still negotiating among ourselves. What does this mean? Net return margin, the higher the net return margin, the higher the death rate. We haven't figured that out yet.
Net return margin is like profit margin?
Yes. To tell the truth, I can't really explain net return margin. I have to have the economist here. But it's a more complicated formula. Net income, it's actually net patient revenue divided by two other things. So I'm not the economist part. But that one is not as hard to understand. Then just demographics again. Quartiles, you expect 25% in each quartile, which since nonprofits were the biggest, they work out. That's the next slide. Showing debt. This is the most interesting, debt. Debt is bad at private hospitals. That was, I think, the most striking finding. Percentage-wise, there's big differences between private hospitals and government hospitals. I did the quartiles based on all 260,000 records. But you can see private hospitals tend to have a lot less debt compared to government and have higher profit margins. I mean, you would expect that. And they have less expensive stuff. Again, you'd expect that from a private for-profit hospital. Conclusion, money does seem to matter. There is a relationship between money and death, but it's not entirely what expected. In general, more money is better, but there was at least one case where more money or more money coming in was not associated with lower mortality rates. And there is some variation by ownership type. Limitations. Sepsis, it's getting easier to define sepsis, more codes, but especially prior to about 2004, before severe septic diagnosis became widely used, it's harder to pick them out. How do you model it? I'm still working on that. I think I picked the best way, but you know, we tried a variety of examples. And so what? You know, do you use cutoffs, quartiles? What's the best way to really use money measures? And then the next one, so how? How does net income margin relate to quality of care and mortality? That's another paper. So thank you for listening. And that's my presentation.
So we have 15 minutes left in this session to discuss any of these papers.
I'll just go sit down now.
So I think we're small enough. We can be informal. We don't have to force people to sit in any particular place to field questions. If we had particular questions as to this most recent talk, perhaps we could start there. Or we can let our speaker who needs to run to the airport.
I will just bolt immediately. I'll go see him. Take a little minute.
So I guess with respect to this last question, you're working with economists, but are you working with people who really understand the financials at hospitals?
Perhaps not.
So I would really suggest
that's the next stage.
That you want to get a collaborator who can help you really understand how these measures might interact at the hospital.
From a technical standpoint, just getting risk adjustment took a lot of effort.
I can believe that.
But now I'm ready to deal more.
One, two.
We did just a brief sort of descriptive study of mortality related to various kinds of diagnoses. We found a very high mortality rate among folks with septicemia, and that one of the related problems was that where they did do testing for antibiotic resistance, a very small percent actually were tested for antibiotic resistance, but where they did, a high percent of those tests were positive. So there's something, I think, in your mix around mortality about how staff and labs are financed. Might be related to the question about somebody who knows about hospital financing.
Okay, so the lab work, how it's done.
And
it's done.
How readily they do it, how quickly they do it. And
there's kind of an issue with the cost of active surveillance for antibiotic resistant organisms in hospitals. Not to make a joke, but the hospitals are somewhat resistant to doing this because the protocols aren't well defined and it's very labor intensive. Already compromising the staffing ratios. They're not trying to take on more stuff to do, but by the same token, in terms of knowing, you know, what patient mix are you dealing with. We've been looking, for example, at community acquired versus hospital acquired penicillin resistant staphylococcus aureus infections, and there's some really interesting trends going on in California. I don't know that we can say it's uniformly distributed across all of the hospitals, but the state definitely.
Well, just to get it done, I mean, at Loma Linda, Dr. Nguyen is the sepsis champion. That's his mission. He's spearheading the effort, and even with him being in charge of it over a two-year period, you know, only about half of the cases actually get the bundle fall implemented. It's just people are busy, doctors are coming and going, patients are coming in the ER. It's hard to actually do the whole appropriate care.
And can I just add one more thing to this? A meeting last Friday, Arnold Milstein from Pacific Business Group on Health is the one of the big purchaser industry groups that works in the healthcare realm. Anyway, he announced the results of a recent really big study on financial incentives related to infection control. And the basic finding of their study was that in response to the question, do hospitals lose money when patients have antibiotic resistance? They gain money.
What happens is that a person goes in with a relatively low-cost DRG, and they get an infection, and it often bumps them into a very serious one of these post-hoc DRGs, which has a very high reimbursement because you're doing a trach or you're, you know, something like that, and the net effect is positive for the bottom line of the hospital. So that's something that people have noticed and think is perhaps a perverse incentive that we might think about.
So it would affect mortality rates related to sepsis.
You were looking at death following sepsis, or were you looking at the development of sepsis?
Usually at all cause inpatient mortality.
Okay.
So I don't know if they came in with sepsis or they got it during
time.
But on average, there's about a 19-day length of stay for sepsis patients.
Right.
Versus five or six for non.
So it seems that this really is a two-stage process that you might want to try to unpack. And one of them is the extent to which the hospital is good at preventing people from getting sepsis, like in really good procedures around central line placement, versus once somebody has sepsis, how quickly they can jump on it and prevent that. So maybe if you try to break it apart, that would be useful. Did you still have a question or?
Well, because it's probably more of a comment. One of the things you might be able to do is use the present on admission flag in our data to try to separate out. If someone presented with septicemia, then you could kind of lay to rest the question of, you know, what is the hospital practice internally, and just focus on, you know, how are they treating that? Are they using the bundle of admission?
So again, it's the two very different questions about allowing sepsis to develop, or possibly you might be a hospital which is the receiver of people who have sepsis more than others, and so you might have more deaths because you are receiving sicker people, and you really want to separate that. It's the same thing like looking at nursing homes and saying how many of your patients have bed sores. Well, if your receptor stream has a lot of people who come in with bed sores, you're going to have a lot more bed sores even if you do a great job of treating them. Because over a 6 month period, there's maybe a 50% chance of getting rid of a bed sore that somebody came with, but there's only a 1-2% chance in a good hospital developing a bed sore. So it's that separating the two kinds of questions. Other commentary? Yes, of course.
I was just wanted to comment Nelson Chan's presentation, and I was thinking about home care and how, you know, the delivery of home health care could impact, you know, of course it's another research project, but I think it would be very, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but very interesting to compare to see whether, you know, the impact of the size of home health care after an ambulatory procedure.
Really interesting question. And we could do this for inpatients, with home follow-up and outpatient follow-up. But I don't know, do outpatient surgery centers have home health care follow-up? Is this often included? Does anybody know?
I'm sorry, being from Canada, I don't know your system, and maybe it's not the...
Short answer is it depends.
It depends. So some do and some don't, but that's a really interesting question.
Hardly any of them will have associated home care
routines or
segments that are attached to them. On the other hand, especially given your data, a lot of folks are having gastrostomies and so on and so forth, which are procedures which frequently are associated with needing home care after them. So there, a lot of those folks will probably have home care in place, probably put in place somewhere else. In other words, put in place by the primary care physician or put in place by the hospital prior to their getting the gastrostomy.
And maybe you can find it in the data set.
Yeah, well, we have no data about home health care. Except on the social services side, you know which families are getting payments. They're publicly funded.
I mean, the interval between, you know, ambulatory admission and the procedures and the nature of some of those procedures, I mean, who gets a gastroscopy and certain of those other procedures are very sick people.
Yeah.
And so that they obviously, you know, have other severe conditions, and it just, you know, so looking at it as a discrete episode of care, I don't know how much that's going to tell us in the continuum of, you know, what that individual patient really is needing, or even how our system is functioning, you know, really.
Yeah.
But doesn't that raise the question of whether, I mean, specifically for very sick patients, it seems scarier on the face of it to have them at an ambulatory
But system. Coming in 2 weeks later, I mean, very few were admitted within 24 hours, and many were admitted a week or two later. So therefore, they had a week or two at home before they went into the hospital for, because we don't know, they were just admitted. We don't know that the procedure really was the reason they were admitted.
Correct. That was just complicated beyond we could. So that's why we said the 15.
Yeah, that's, that, I mean, that's,
let me show you something.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we don't know that the gastrostomy tube got infected and blah, blah, blah.
They just got,
you know.
If you're having a gastrostomy, you are sick, period.